Dr. James Wright has worked as a field archaeologist, historic stone specialist, archival researcher, and buildings archaeologist. In 2020, he began writing the Medieval Myth-Busting blog, which seeks to investigate and debunk commonly believed and repeated stories about ancient buildings. Dr. Wright joins the Plutopia podcast this time as we discuss his career and his latest book, Historic Building Myth-Busting.
People don't like their truths, their entries, their stories being questioned, being queried. But I always try and do this by presenting all the evidence. Now, that in this anti-truth environment that we live in at the moment, post-truth world, that doesn't always work. Logic and reason and evidence are discounted by people. It's feelings and emotion for most people at this point, which is why I do try and deliver some of these debunkings in a wry and exasperated and humorous sort of way. I do find that humour can sometimes help it across the line, trying to meet people halfway rather than just standing up and being bullheaded and trying to shout them down. That's never going to win you and any fans at all. But I always do show my working out. I always do show where the evidence comes from. I do think that the truth is fundamentally important.
Hey, welcome to the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, and I'm joined by my partner in crime, Scoop Sweeney, and our co-host, Wendy Grossman, who's logging in from Pennsylvania, though she's usually logging in from London. We are very pleased to have as our guest today a man who is a buildings archaeologist. We're going to be diving beneath floorboards, up into attics, through hidden passages of history with Dr. James Wright, founder of, and I want to get this pronunciation right, is it Triskele?
Triskele Heritage.
Okay. He's the founder of Triskele Heritage, and for more than 20 years, two decades, James has been rummaging through cellars, sifting garden soil, and decoding centuries-old masonry to uncover how everyday and not-so-everyday people really lived in the medieval world. And you might know him from his hit Medieval Myth-Busting blog, and if you haven't seen it, look it up. His appearances on Time Team and The Great British Dig, or his recent book, Historic Building Mythbusting, from the History Press. So get ready to separate fact from folklore as we welcome Dr. James Wright to the podcast.
Wow, thank you very much. As introductions go, that was very comprehensive, and I think we can score it very highly in competition with all the other podcasts that I've done. A true 9.5 out of 10. Well done.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I guess our first question is kind of where you primarily focus as an archaeologist of historic buildings. What kinds of buildings do you consider?
So I look at, well, have historically looked at all standing buildings. I'm interested with almost anything with a roof on it, to be honest with you. But I've looked at probably the earliest buildings I've looked at have been 12th century, maybe a late 11th century. And I've gone all the way through well into the 20th century. Everything has an archaeology, and you can study the archaeology of music or the archaeology of sport. And I just happened to study the archaeology of buildings. And because you can go back and look at how buildings have been used and developed, you can do that all over the world because there are structures built by most communities, most societies. I happen to have grown up in central England. And as a result, I've always looked at what I know, the buildings in my area. Now, I do work all over the British Isles, but primarily I can be found in the bottom half, if you like, of England. So maybe working from places like Yorkshire and Lancashire downwards towards the English Channel. And I really specialise in medieval buildings. So we're looking at buildings from about 1000 AD through to about 1500 or thereabouts. But also I go on And I'm quite happy looking at what we call the early modern period. So the period of the Tudors and the Stuarts in the 16th and 17th centuries. I'll freely admit that I do start to glaze over and get a little bit bored somewhere after the British Civil Wars. So somewhere in the second half of the 17th century, I find my enthusiasm dwindling a little bit. But that's not to say that I haven't done lots of buildings post that. And I've been doing this for actually now more like 25 years as a professional archaeologist and trying to help people to understand the development of the buildings that they live and work in.
So you're not just studying buildings, you're also myth busting.
Ah.
What's the approach for myth busting?
Okay, so when I go around and essentially help people to understand things like the form and the function, the materials and the fabric, the setting and the context, the phasing and development of their buildings, very frequently the same stories crop up. And this happens all over the country. You get the same groups of stories. And these might include people who live or work in a timber frame building, and they will say, ah, the timbers of this building were reclaimed from warships. And sometimes they'll go into very great detail and say it was one of the Spanish Armada ships which was wrecked and they reclaimed the timbers and into the building it went. Or the other very common one is the Battle of Trafalgar. That crops up quite a bit. And these stories are told the length and breadth of the country. Another classic of the genre, which you alluded to in the introduction, is that there are hidden tunnels underneath the landscape, and such a building is connected to another building over there, 5 miles away, or something like that, via a secret passage. And there's fervent belief in stories such as this. And they are told all over the country, and people rarely critically evaluate them. They rarely say, oh, but is this true? What's the practicalities? What's the realities here? Do we have any evidence? Most people are connected to these stories on an emotional level. They say something about the societies and individuals that tell them. And because I've encountered these stories for so long, gradually I began to understand that the folklore, the yarns, the tales, the myths, the legends form a corpus of tales which are told everywhere. And I wanted to try and initially ask questions of them. Are they ever true? Is there any evidence to say, well, this one could be correct? And then, if there isn't the evidence, well, can we debunk the tales? Can we sort of say why they're not true? But then, can we go on a step further to explain actually where they come from? Why do people believe them? Why are they so intimately connected to them? And why are they successful? Why do so many millions of people believe and repeat them every day? And that sort of became, I suppose, my central tenet of my career for a number of years. I started writing that book 5 years ago, and I did the blog concurrently. And the book got published about a year ago. It's just been released in America. So finally, it's available via online outlets in America as of last month, in that's May 2025. And I've been touring the thing all around the United Kingdom too, going to lots of places and talking about it. And I've done lots of media for it too. So this is a nice opportunity to do another podcast.
I was reading your blog and was fascinated by your investigations into pubs and their backstories. They all seem to love 3-digit years of their creation. How did you get involved with that?
So pubs do feature quite a bit in the book. The Secret Passage chapter has lots of pubs within it. There's lots of pubs which are said to have hidden tunnels, often going to churches or cathedrals or monasteries or the like. They also feature in the ship timber chapter because there is lots of them that claim to have reclaimed ship timbers. That seems to be part of their mythos, their offer to customers. And then finally, in the very last chapter, which is the longest one in the book, it's about 12,000 words long, I essentially went on the craziest pub crawl you could imagine. I went all over the country trying to find Britain's oldest pub because there's so many pubs that make the claim to be the oldest in the town, the county, or the country. And there's about two dozen pubs which claim to be the oldest in England or Britain. And of course, they can't all be correct. And some of these, as you say, really do claim great, great antiquity. The earliest claim that I know of is the old ferry boat at a place called Holywell, which is in Cambridgeshire. And they claim to have been open consistently since 560 AD. And that's a really, really long time ago. This is in what we would call now the early medieval period. It's roughly about 150 years after the Romans left. Now, this is a period in time where we're not even sure if King Arthur was alive and actually existed. So how can we be sure that there's been a pub serving beer for 1500 years? And the curious thing about this particular claim, which is, I think, typical of the claims, is that there's no evidence to back it up. They've painted the information on the sign and people repeat it because they think, well, surely it's been fact-checked. Surely it must be true. If they've put it on the sign, they've put it on the website, they've put it on the menus in the pub, that kind of thing. They can't be lying to us. Well, actually, at some point, somebody has dreamed up that story. We must gloss over why they might have done that, but we might speculate that money's at the heart of that to draw in the tourists, to draw in the locals, to draw in the punters. And they've got away with it, in a sense, because lots of people believe it, lots of people advocate for it. There are people that are really strongly attached to those stories because they want their local pub or the pub they visited on holiday to genuinely be the oldest pub in the country. Now, in reality, the building is about 1,000 years later, dates to the very late medieval period, and then there's quite a lot of it that's even later than that. It opened as a pub even later than that in the post-medieval period. And they're relying on the fact that people don't know the difference between a structure of about 1500 and a structure of about 560, 6th century, essentially.
Well, you know, to an American tourist, everything looks old.
And that plays a big part in it. And people come from all over the world to go to these pubs. So the nearest one to me, our East Midlands local claimant for oldest pub in England, is the trip to Jerusalem, which is famous the world over. People come from all over the world to have a pint there. I used to work there in the late 90s, and we had people coming from New Zealand, from Australia, from all over America, from Canada, to have a pint in what purports to be the oldest pub in England. And it's got the signage on the wall, dates to 1189, even says the oldest inn in England. And yet, it's a late 17th century building. Its famous caves out the back are also 17th century in date. And it wasn't open as a pub until the middle years of the 18th century. And we know all this. It's the archaeology speaks volumes. You can tell the date of a building by looking at the details of its construction. In this instance, it's the detail of the timber framing of the trip. And then the archival record fills in the rest because we find that the first record of its use as a pub is 1751. So the evidence is out there, but it's never really looked at by the claimants because they pick a crazy early date and go for that one. And as I say, there's about two dozen all over the country with various advocates. So I looked at all of these claimants and what did I find? Well, of the pubs that claim to be the oldest, not one of them has got the evidence, the chops to back it up. But you can go and use archaeology. You can use the archival records. You can use the building as an object with a biography and a material culture that can be read. And you can sometimes use dendrochronology, the science of tree ring dating of the timbers which were felled, converted, and built into the very fabric of these structures. And you can go and look for the oldest pub in the country. And when I found it, I discovered that they don't make the claim to be the oldest pub in the country. I found that there's a pub in Somerset, in a place called Norton St. Philip, a pub called the George Inn, which has been continuously serving since the later 14th century. And that is the oldest pub that I could find with the evidence to back it up.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So, can you say a little bit about what analysis you did to completely verify, to convince yourself that that's really the oldest pub?
Sure. So I use the techniques of buildings archaeology, which I've just alluded to just in the last bit of the chat. I looked at the archival record, the fact that this pub had been developed by local monks from 2 miles away at a place called Hinton Charterhouse to essentially act as a commercial venture. They had these wool fairs which brought income to the monastery, and initially they were held at the monastery, but that's noisy, there's lots of visitors, it disrupts the quiet sanctity of the monastic precinct. So in the middle years of the 14th century, they shifted those fairs 2 miles down the road to the village of Norton St. Philip, and that was successful, and the monks realized we need to build an infrastructure. And so the archival record indicates that by the later 14th century, they were developing this great big inn with a huge courtyard and all the ancillary buildings that you need, your buttery for storing beer and your pantry for bread to serve up to the guests. It's got a great big kitchen, there's stabling, there's lots and lots of rooms, chambers for storage and for staying over in. It was an impressive venture. And then the archaeology confirms that stylistically, the earliest bit of the building looks to be late 14th century from the detailing of its windows. There's then a really big transformation of the building in the 1430s, and we've got the date of that transformation from the tree ring analysis. So we can bring all of that archaeology to bear to say that we've got a late 14th century inn which was redeveloped in the earlier 15th century. And then there's changes, there's constant changes throughout its history, but it's still recognizably a building of that period. It has bits added to it, bits taken away from it, but it's been doing continuous service, and there's enough of that original fabric to make the case for it being the oldest pub in the country. And then when you kind of line up all of the other surviving medieval inns, you find that none of the others quite have the proof available to be able to counter that one, to be able to go a little bit earlier than the later 14th century. There are one or two of them which I'm a little uncertain about their date. So there's one called the Bull Hotel, which is in Ludlow in Shropshire. And the front range there is notionally dated to somewhere in the 14th century on stylistic grounds of the details of its roof structure. And then its rearrange in the courtyard is 15th century, but it's never had tree ring dating. And I just wonder if we went to the Bull Hotel, if we commissioned some dendrochronology, whether that actually might pip the Georgian at Norton St. Philip to the post, because that has the potential sometimes. So some of this is a little bit uncertain, but the one that we could be sure about, namely from the archives, from the archaeology, and from the dendro, it is on present evidence the Georgian at Norton St. Philip.
So, how many pubs did you have to visit in order to establish this?
I will freely say that I didn't do this all in a block. I didn't go on a sort of several months long trip. Just the practicalities of that would be very, very expensive. Rail travel and overnight accommodation and food and all that kind of thing would make it difficult. But I had visited a significant number of these buildings just during the course of the last 25 years. So I've been able to look at them sometimes in a casual basis, sometimes in a more formal setting over the years. But also, I was doing quite a lot of it remotely as well, because there's quite a lot of publications. Actually, not a lot, but there's a reasonable number of publications, including a small number of pretty good surveys of some of these buildings. So there's a good survey, for example, of the Angel and Royal at Grantham in Lincolnshire, which was looked at maybe about 10 or 15 years ago by a chap called Philip Dixon, who was actually my mentor at the University of Nottingham. And he published a very good survey of the Angel at Grantham, which proved, I think, beyond all reasonable doubt, that the origin of that building is middle 15th century on stylistic grounds. And so there were these reports that I could look at, but I could also go and check those buildings myself as well. So it was done more ad hoc and it was done piecemeal. I couldn't really group it all together and say, this is how long it took me to do it. I did it all in one block because essentially the field work for the book essentially has been going on all of my career, and I've been able to draw on elements of the surveys that I've been doing since the very, very late 90s or early 2000s. So that's kind of how it came together. It's been drawing together threads and strands and observations over a quarter of a century.
It's longer than that, isn't it? Because you basically grew up in a pub with a secret passage.
So Wendy is alluding to a conversation that we've had a couple of times recently about my background. I grew up in a small market town in central Staffordshire in the English Midlands called Stone, and this was a medieval market town that grew up outside the gates of a medieval monastery, Stone Priory. Very little of that still standing. And it developed and became a reasonably important market town with canal trade in the 18th century. And I grew up in this pub right on the very edge called the Pheasant Inn, and it dated to about the 1850s. My first job, probably about age 6 or 7, was what was called bottling up. It was replacing the bottles that had been sold the previous day by going down into the cellar, bringing up the orders and putting them onto the shelves and into the fridges. And I did this every morning until I was probably about 15 or 16. And going down into the cellar, going down into that subterranean space, it was dark, it was cool, it was slightly damp, moisture in the air, had a very otherworldly feel. Even though it was a perfectly prosaic, small two-room cellar, going down there at 6 in the morning was very atmospheric. And for somebody that had grown up reading history books, but also had grown up reading medieval poems and stories of adventure like the Famous Five or the Secret Seven or Alan Garner's Weird Stone of Bisingamen, books which had lots of subterranea about them. It was very easy to get romantic, to get thinking about could there be a secret passage, because there was a story in the town that the priory was connected to a place called Aston Hall, a 2 mile tunnel underground, and that the monks used to use that. So this was a famous story in our town, and I was always looking for the entrance, even though our pub was nowhere near the proposed route. I really came to want that to be a thing that was true, and I was always on the lookout whenever we visited an old building for a possible secret passage. And of course, later in life, as an archaeologist, I maybe lost the enchantment of that folklore and became quite hard-headed for quite a long time. But coming again and looking at stories of secret passages and essentially debunking them and realizing that actually there's no archaeological evidence for any hidden tunnel. As the stories say, there are escape tunnels or the secret access tunnels. They stretch across the landscape, miles in many cases. No evidence for any of this. But realizing that and then coming to understand the importance of those stories to communities, to understand that they're based on really, really old storytelling, that people are often told them as children, as I was, often by loved ones, and they want them to be true, and they look for the smallest piece of evidence, a blocked door or a slight depression in a road or in a field must be evidence of the secret tunnel. This is all sort of our cultural DNA, if you like. And I was, as a child, as an adolescent, as susceptible to that storytelling as anybody else was. As an archaeologist, I then became hard-headed, but latterly I've become re-enchanted by the folklore as well, as I've come to understand the stories behind the stories, and I've come to understand the importance of what that folklore can tell us about the communities that relay it. And it all, as Wendy says, it all comes back to growing up in this public house in Staffordshire in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I wanted to clarify that. So that was like the family business and your family lived in the house. Is that the way it was?
Yeah. So it was a traditional boozer, a traditional pub, which served the local community, and we had all sorts of people. It was a real mixing pot, if you like, mostly working class people. We had a lot of draymen who actually delivered beer to other pubs. We had plumbers and electricians and builders, and we had a smattering of postmen that used to come in as well. Lots of factory workers. There would also be more middle class people. There was a group of solicitors, lawyers who would come in. We had a guy who was a bookkeeper, and there was quite a reasonably famous artist who lived directly opposite. So there was a real mixing pot of different people who were drinking there. They were all mostly real ale aficionados, and we would get some of the real ale trade as well coming up from the canal and travellers and that kind of thing. But it was a real community pub. It was on the corner of Terrace Street, Brick Terrace Street, so it really felt part of it. It was purpose built as a pub, and it felt part of its community. And there would be tales told around that bar during the day and at night as well. And working behind the bar, working in the kitchen, I picked up on many of those tales. And one of those stories that was repeated and dissected a lot was this one of the secret passage, the supposed secret passage from Stone Priory to Aston Hall. And that was something that I grew up hearing in the pub.
Does this mean that when you were, as you grew older, you were able to sample the wares? I ask you that because I grew up, my father was in the beer business, and among a certain set of people in my high school, I was fairly popular because I was able to get my hands on cans of beer, you know?
I mean, I grew up at a time I was coming into my adolescence during the early 90s, and underage drinking was a lot more prevalent then anyway. It was easier to get served in pubs than it is now. There was no sort of ID. Very few pubs actually really questioned it. As long as you weren't behaving like an absolute plonker, then you were probably going to get served in most cases. That's all changed now. But, I grew up, I was certainly drinking underage in my dad's pub. And then by knowing some of the landlords in the town as well, they were never really querying that. So I've grown up with a fairly healthy respect for alcohol and a fairly unhealthy appreciation of it as well.
I noticed you have also been investigating buildings, I suppose, about their paranormal claims. Have you found any ghosts?
Ghosts is something that I leave alone. I think there's more people that are more well qualified to talk about the folklore of ghosts, whether it's from a point of skepticism or a point of querying or a point of firm belief. There are many other people who are more better qualified than I am. I've worked in buildings all of my professional life that are said to be haunted, and yet I've never seen anything at all. Even when I've stayed over solo in these buildings, I've never encountered anything at all. But what I have done more recently, this isn't in my book, but it is on my blog, is starting to query some of the pseudo histories which have been claimed by some paranormal locations. So there are some properties which are in old buildings with genuine histories where the owners or the people that run the paranormal events have been, shall we say, talking up certain fake histories, pseudo histories, inventing a macabre or a more macabre history for the building, basically to hang the framework of the ghost stories off. And that kind of using a falsified history for financial gain causes me quite a bit of disquiet, because those histories do come to be believed by wider communities, and they infiltrate popular histories as well. So if you go to some of these sites and look at their Wikipedia entries, it's the false histories which are then backed up by these websites making the claims. That's the citations. And that, I think, is dangerous. So I have called out one or two of those properties that have been doing that. And I have done a debunking exercise on some of those buildings. And all I would really encourage these paranormal events groups or the owners of these buildings is to actually look at the real history of these buildings. Because if you do go into the detail of these properties, you will find interesting stories. You don't need to make it up. There will be something that will be there that will act as a draw for your potential customer base. So, you know, for example, if you're looking for a macabre history, I did a survey a good while ago now of a railway tunnel that goes underneath the Albert Dock in the Docklands of London. It's a mile and a half long, this thing is, dates to the middle years of the 19th century. And it was a great big thing that was being brought back into use as part of the Elizabeth line, the new Crossrail line in London. And we were down there for a week or so. It was a huge, great big thing. And it was only after the survey that I then went to do the archival history of the thing, and looking through newspaper accounts from the 1870s, found a piece of macabre history whereby a gunner from the Woolwich Arsenal had been going out on a date with his fiancée. He'd been going through a lot of debt. He was facing Great Depression, and he essentially pulled out a pistol and he shot her and then he shot himself. So there are these macabre histories. You know, some people might say, oh, then his ghost was forever seen in the tunnel. But, you know, those stories do exist if that's what you're interested in. If it is that kind of esoteric, arcane, spooky history, there are these tales out there, you know, in terms of true crime or the like. You can go and research these things. You don't need to necessarily go and invent stories and falsify history, which then gets taken as being real by the community at large.
Are you pissing a lot of people off by busting their myths?
Yeah, great question, John. There are certainly some people that have, shall we say, not reacted well to the truth. And I think, you know, this we can see beyond history, archaeology, heritage, folklore. We can see this as being a national, international issue, essentially, with the democratization of information. There are certain views of the world of the past which are clung to despite all the evidence suggesting otherwise, and you know, there is this sort of anti-truth movement which is problematic. Now, coming back within the heritage world again for a moment, I have certainly upset some people, and I have upset some people within the paranormal community by debunking their claims. There are one or two pub landlords who are perhaps not best pleased. And yet some of them are very, very, very pleased indeed when I've been able to say, well, actually, yours is one of the oldest pubs in the country. And all of a sudden they're offering you pints of beer, and it's all very good. They're happy, I'm happy. No bribery and corruption here, though. But yeah, there have been some people that have reacted extraordinarily badly, and that has played out online on social media. Some people start emailing me and sending me increasingly more furious and unhinged messages, and one or two of them have even turned up at events that I've been doing to actually wag the finger at me and have a good shout. So yeah, people don't like their truths, their own truths, their stories being questioned, being queried. But I always try and do this by presenting all the evidence. Now, that in this anti-truth environment that we live in at the moment, post-truth world, that doesn't always work. Logic and reason and evidence are discounted by people. It's feelings and emotion for most people at this point, which is why I do try and deliver some of these debunkings in a wry and exasperated and humorous sort of way. I do find that humour can sometimes help it across the line, trying to meet people halfway rather than just standing up and being bullheaded and trying to shout them down. That's never going to win you and any fans at all. But I always do show my working out. I always do show where the evidence comes from. I do think that the truth is fundamentally important.
Is it true that you do a 12-hour one-man conference where you talk for 12 hours?
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that. How many times have I done that now? Is it two or three? Yeah, I have done that. Yeah.
What do you talk about for 12 hours?
Well, I've got a very, very, very big back catalogue of public lectures because I've been a public speaker for, oh gosh, 21 years, and I've built up a huge, library of lectures. But with these one-man conferences, what I do them online. I do them over Zoom. I start at 10 in the morning. I finish at 10 at night. We usually get an audience of about, at any given time, about 150 to 200 people. Usually bookings of about 300 across the day. And people just turn up and see which talk they want to, or some make it through all of it. And I talk about medieval and early modern buildings. I focus on that. Usually I'll do some oldies, greatest hits, if you like, some of the talks that have been quite popular. I'll try and theme the day so that there's a through conversation going on, but I'll also offer new talks as well. So the last one that I did a few months ago, I think I did two brand new bespoke talks as well to act as an offer to people who had maybe seen some of the older stuff. So I did a talk on the secrets of ancient walls, looking at the wall in detail, something that we possibly don't even consider, the very walls of our building. Well, let's look at how they go together. Let's look at their kind of folklore. Let's look at some of the archaeological clues contained within them. And then I did the same, but looking at floors as well, which I liked your introduction earlier when you said lifting the floorboards, because I've literally done that in some buildings where we've actually popped up the floorboards to see what lies beneath.
I was looking at another of your blog entries, Sex, Stone Mansions, and the Sacred, and I was entranced. And this is an adult only kind of podcast. So, can you explain more about what you found as far as sex and stonemasons?
So this is a blog that later went on to become about half of one of my book chapters in Historic Building Mythbusting. And this relates to a popular story about church architecture, because within medieval churches, which are supposed to be holy and sanctified and, beautiful and representative of the Catholic medieval religion, there are an incredibly large number of obscene carvings. And when I say obscene, I mean absolute, to our minds, filth. There are people up on the walls masturbating. There are people fucking in every possible combination that you could possibly imagine. There's same sex action going on up there. There's people sucking their own cocks. There's people rimming themselves. Anything that you can possibly imagine and see in a modern porno is going on up on the walls. And I can see here that we're screen sharing the Laxton Demon, where we've got a demon who is swallowing into his throat a very, very, very naked man who is presenting his buttocks. You can see the sphincter, you can see this massive cock and balls. That dates to the 15th century. And the stories about these things tend to be that they are, in a sense, stonemasons' jokes or stonemasons' satires or stonemasons' complaints. The story usually is repeated is that the mason hasn't been paid properly, if at all. And so they pop these carvings in to essentially bring the church down, to satirize the priest, or to say what they think of the bishop or the clerk of the works. And that story is told the length of the country. And yet, it's a curious one because some of these are really noticeable. So that Laxton Demon is about 3 foot high. He's a really, really big boy, and you can't miss him. That's the sort of thing that gets noticed. You can't just slip it past the church authorities. And yet, the length and breadth of the country, we've got literally hundreds of these carvings. There's no court cases where a stonemason's brought up and told off for, and fined or put in prison for putting these in there. And we can only understand really that they've been put there with the tacit or even direct commission of the church themselves. And so I've looked at that. I've looked at what's going on here. Why are there so many naughty, obscene carvings in the churches? What I found really blew my mind, because they seem to be representative of a very, now very, very obscure form of theology called negative mysticism, which basically says that you need, if you're going to be a good Christian, to take your place to the darkest place. You need to go to the darkest place. You need to face temptation. You need to face the ultimate sins. And if you can overcome that, if you can take your place, yourself to a place of disarrangement, the furthest away from sanctity you possibly can, only then can you overcome temptation and damnation and receive ultimate enlightenment and salvation. And this was quite a common theology that was being propounded by the church fathers that we've just forgotten about because it's 500 years since medieval Catholicism. And these carvings are part of that. They also seem to say that there's something of the liminal going on here. They tend to be in locations which are high up or associated with doorways, and they seem to speak of an intangible spirituality to say that you are within a place that is not quite of one world and not quite of the other world. So they're reminding you of this supernatural spirituality which is around you. So there's all sorts of reminders. I also think they're moral warnings as well. So the Laxton demon's a good one because essentially the little naked man is being consumed by the forces of hell. He's being punished. He's being sent to hell, and this is reminiscent of the doom paintings, which used to be over the chancel arch in churches, where you would look up and see Christ in majesty, and on his right hand would be all of the faithful, the good people who were rising up from the graves on the day of judgment to be brought into paradise. But on his left-hand side are all the sinners, and they're being pushed into the maw of hell, the mouth of hell. And a lot of them are often naked. And so I think this is a representation of this sort of scene of what could happen to you if you continue to be a naughty boy. So there's a moral teaching there. And I've mentioned before that I also think that they're using humor in a way that is somewhat analogous to how I use humor to get myth busting across the line in the modern age. I think they're doing preaching using humor as well. So rather than hectoring from the pulpit, what they're doing is they're putting these moral warnings up there, but they're often making them deliberately funny so that people aren't sort of repulsed by the idea. It's like, oh, do you remember when old Baldric was running down the street after too much beer one night and he pulled his breeches down? Oh, well, old Baldric's probably off to hell then, isn't he? It's a warning not to be like that, to not overconsume the ale on a Saturday night. And this idea of humour being earthy and naughty, I mean, come on, that's there in some of the greatest literature of the medieval period. You read your Chaucer, it's filth. There's so many reprobates in there. People are getting their bums and their dicks out all the time. There's proper sex in there as well, and that is a the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer and his other writings. They're being written for the royal court of Richard II. This isn't earthy humor for peasants. This is high art for the royal court. So this kind of use of humor, use of obscenity is seen across society in the medieval period. So we perhaps shouldn't be surprised to see these scenes in churches, but we must also just not miss the fact that to the modern eye, they are scatological, they are humorous, and we are going to have a chuckle at them. And they are quite popular when they're spotted. And yet, in the Victorian period, when churches were being restored, there was a real interest in the period of the medieval, in the Victorian era. We see these great restorations. They're noticing these features, but to the prudish Victorian mind, they're alarming, and they can't possibly conceive that the church would have commissioned these things, and yet they did. So what the Victorians do is start to concoct these stories about stonemasons and their anti-establishment ways and the fact that they do this to satirize the church. And that comes through into the 20th century. So a lot of the stories that I do debunk in the blog and within the book are essentially coming out of the Victorian world, and we've inherited their way of thinking.
Have you had any big surprises where your own misconceptions were challenged by your research?
That's a really good question. Thank you, John. Yes, I mentioned right at the beginning this story of ship timbers, the reuse of them, and the idea that so many of them were salvaged from the Spanish Armada or the Battle of Trafalgar. And 99.99 recurring percent of claims of ship timbers in buildings is untrue. It's the romanticism of the sea, the island nation, the maritime naval conquests, the development of the British Empire. You can see where those stories come from, why they're so popular. Also, just a misreading, a misinterpretation of the evidence. There's very little evidence for the reuse of ship timbers. But when I did approach that chapter, I did find that sometimes there are a vanishingly small corpus of examples when there are genuine ship timbers. Now, I've been doing building surveys. I've done hundreds of them in my career, and I've only seen it twice, where there is a genuine ship timber in a building. And of those occasions, that only happened during a professional survey that I was commissioned to do once in my entire quarter of a century career. And that was in a small cottage overlooking the harbour at Whitby in North Yorkshire, a famous town for all sorts of reasons, of course, most famously for its associations with Bram Stoker's Dracula. But historically, this was a big fishing port, but also a shipbuilding and shipbreaking port as well. And because this cottage is only within spitting distance of the harbour, a few of those timbers did end up coming up the cliff in the probably later 18th century and were incorporated. And they're part of the ribs of a large boat or a small ship. And they were incorporated in the collar of a roof structure, in the lintels of two doors, and the bracket of a fireplace. So just four timbers that I've seen during professional surveys, but perhaps not a great surprise given the context of the finds in Whitby, but also the time period as well. Because by the industrial period, by the later 18th century, there was a genuine lack of building timber, of oak in particular, in this country. And that's when we start to see imports coming from the Baltic and indeed from America as well. And you can see that there may have been a temptation to reuse some of the better preserved bits of timber. But think about it logically. You've got a timber which has spent years, decades at sea. It's not going to be in great shape as a result of the salination, as a result of the wet and the pressures of the wind and the seas. It's not going to be in great condition. Also, old oak is like bell metal. It's like concrete. It's really, really hard and heavy to work with. What carpenters really wanted was fresh green oak, still with the sap, still with the resins, and they can essentially cut that almost like butter. They don't want the hard stuff that's essentially knackered. But there are a small number of cases where they were forced into using it at that later period in the 18th and the 19th century. So that was really the one time where I was challenged, because I genuinely thought that all of these rumours of ship timbers was untrue. But I did find, reading around and looking at other people's surveys, and then also encountering this in my own work when doing a survey in Whitby, that it is in a vanishingly small number of cases true. But in the book, in the nine chapters that I look at, that was the only one where the myth was sometimes correct.
We haven't talked about castles at all. I'm actually staying with a friend, and I asked her if she knew why staircases in castles, medieval castles, tend to spiral to the right. And she said, well, for the sword arm. Now, this is a woman who reads quite a lot and reads a lot about medieval architecture, so I was a little surprised.
I mean, this is such a common story, Wendy, isn't it? The idea that all spiral staircases in castles turn to the right, clockwise, to advantage right-handed defenders who are fighting downhill, if you like, and the attackers coming up the hill, swinging their swords, the newel post, the column running up the centre of the stair turret is going to impede the swing of their sword. And this story is told all over the place. It will have been told somewhere today. It's told by visitors to castles, tour guides. There's plenty of historians who I think probably should know better that have repeated it and do repeat it. It's on TV, it's on radio, it's on podcasts, it's in magazines, it's in newspapers, it's on websites, it's in the history books. It's so common. And it's for many people, it's the one thing that they know about castles. So anecdotally, I stood on the bottom step of the Mortimer's Tower at Ludlow, a 13th century tower with a spiral staircase that does turn clockwise in 2022. And I counted how many times that story was told, and I heard it six times in under 5 minutes. And it wasn't even a busy day. That's how popular this story is. And when it was being told, it was always an elder male telling it to a woman or a younger child. It was never a man to a man. It seemed to be there was a kind of a hierarchy, but it was always an elder male. It's a boy's story. It's a martial story. It's a tough story. And yet, not a word of it is true. Not a word of it is based on the lived reality of the medieval period. Because 30% of spiral staircases go the other way, they go anti-clockwise and always have done. Right, going back to the Norman conquest and the Anarchy of Stephen and through to the Edwardian conquest of Wales, all of the castles of these, well, not all of them, but many castles of those periods have got spiral staircases which go the other way. So are we to expect that patrons and builders were deliberately hamstringing their soldiers? Or does the story not stack up? Because we have absolutely no evidence for any kind of fighting on staircases throughout the entire medieval period. And logically, if you're fighting on the staircases, the game's up and you've already lost. Also, practically, it doesn't really stack up. Because if you think about fighting with a heavy weapon in heavy armor, and you're fighting downwards and you're slashing like that, you're going to overbalance yourself. These are steep, these staircases are. And in reality, the guy coming up the stairs, he just wants a short stabbing weapon because he's got access to your feet, your ankles, and your nether regions. So practically, these don't work. They're also really narrow. There's no room for swinging. You can only stab. And, when you think about it, it doesn't stack up. But I went a bit more deep with this one. I wanted to find out where it came from, and I originally thought it was going to be something like an 18th century antiquarian or maybe a military historian from the 19th century. But what really surprised me is how recent the story is. It was first cited in 1902 by an art critic called Theodore Cook. And Cook has an interesting biography because he invented this story himself. It came out of his own head, and he was at the time writing a book about spirals. It's called Spirals in Nature and Art. So of course he had to look at the spiral staircase, or the helical staircase to give it its true name. He was looking at the spiral staircase, and throughout his writings, not just in his spirals book, he's obsessed with left-handers. He's really obsessed with the fact that left-handers, to his mind, excelled at whatever they did. And this always struck me as a bit odd. And I was like, why is he so obsessed with people who use their left hand, thinking that they're great? Then I found out that Cook's real joy in the world was fencing. And he was the founder of Oxford University's fencing club. He sat on the committees of the Amateur Fencing Association, and he picked for the British Olympic Association, and also he was the fencing correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. So this is a guy obsessed with spirals, left-handedness, and fencing. And the reason that the left-handedness comes in is because he'd observed left-handed fencers, and he found that they were often victorious because they knew how a right-hander would fight, and they also knew how a left-hander would fight. But there were so few left-handed fencers that right-handed fencers struggled to find anyone
You
to
see that in
practice against.
tennis.
Yeah,
You see
tennis,
that in pro tennis.
and indeed in boxing as well, with the old southpaws as well. So Cook dreams up this story essentially, and it takes a little while to get hold, but by the early 1910s, an American journalist has repeated it and cited Cook as the originator. And then in the late 1930s, Hollywood produces The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring Errol Flynn. And right at the end of that film, there's a set piece sword fight on a spiral staircase between Flynn and Basil Rathbone as the Sheriff of Nottingham. And that kind of gives people license. Hollywood has shown it, so it must be true. And around the same time, there's a genuine castle specialist called Sidney Toy, who reiterates Theodore Cook's thesis in a popular selling book. So that's given the kind of the historian's credibility. But since that moment, I don't know of any castle specialists worth their salt who've ever believed it or repeated it. But it is a popular story, and it's one that people get proper narky about on the internet. I get a lot of hate mail about this one from old white men.
So, is there actually a real reason why most of them were built most of them were built clockwise? Is there any particular reason, or is it just that that's how people think?
It's difficult to determine, and a few of us have spent probably more time than we should have thinking about this. It has been pointed out that as you go up as you go up a clockwise newel or staircase, your feet will be on the widest part of the tread as you go up, and you can use your left hand, most people being right-handed, to steady yourself on the wall or with a rope or a chain or even a handrail, and have your right hand free for carrying goods. Now, obviously, that doesn't work on your way back down. So it might be to do with the ergonomics of it. There are a few cases where we can be pretty sure that it has to go that way, because by turning it the other way and accessing it from the same place, it would create a kind of an engineering problem, which might lead to having to put the stair turret in an uncomfortable or an unfortunate or an impractical location, or even doubling the size of the turret. There is just a hint that from the middle years of the 13th century, they might have been pairing staircases. So there's these particular gatehouses which have paired staircases in opposing turrets, and one usually goes anti-clockwise and one usually goes clockwise. And there's just a hint that they might be using one-way systems. So you might go up the clockwise and down the anti-clockwise. And there's evidence from that in cathedral towers as well.
I was going to say, because going down and putting your foot on the narrow part of the tread is actually not, doesn't feel very safe.
No, and it isn't at all. No, I've just shimmied up and down most of the Edwardian castles in Wales, which have got multiple types of staircases. And yeah, you don't want to be treading on the narrow point as you come down. So it's difficult to get out because we don't have a manual for castle building at this period in time. They didn't leave us the rationale behind how they designed these places. We have to kind of retro engineer using archaeology to try and inform us as best as we possibly can. And you know, that those are the possibilities that are there, but I don't pretend to have a clear-cut answer to that one. It's just simply that if the story existed before Theodore Cook, it left no trace whatsoever. Ultimately, the story comes out of the martial interpretation of castles as well. Most people wander around the world thinking that castles are defensive military fortifications. And yes, there was an element of security to them, but that security has been rather overstated from the late Victorian period through to the later 20th century. And actually, it kind of masks the obsession with militarism, masks the great complexity of what castles really did in their heyday. And they acted as estate centres, they acted as courts. As places for judiciary, they were charitable institutions. There was strong connections with religion. They were places for hierarchy and pageantry and tournaments and landscapes of lordship, which were attached to them and developed in the landscape beyond. There's an economic aspect to castles with taxes and the like. So there's so much more going on with castles. They're really status display. And showing your prestige through magnificent architecture. And yes, because they are the treasure houses of the mighty, you need to have some security. But the reality that they acted as forts is massively overstated, because when castles are besieged, they don't stand up very well. In Hampshire, the castle had an 85% failure rate. So when they were besieged, they fell on 85% of the occasions. Where I live in Nottinghamshire, the castles fell on 100% of occasions when they were besieged. So ultimately, if they were built as forts, they're particularly rubbish as forts. So there's probably something else going on. And the spiral staircase myth comes out of that old Victorian belief that they were primarily forts. And it's taken a long time, really, the last 40 years, to challenge that and to try and drive that new interpretation through. But most of the general public have not heard those arguments that castle specialists have had. They've not come across these ideas. So as a result, most people are still taught that they are forts primarily.
I'm sitting here thinking of other questions, but we're actually out of time. We've been talking for an hour.
No problem.
So maybe you could come back sometime. And I was going to ask about moats.
I think a lot of us received our knowledge of castles in this country from watching Monty Python.
Of course, of course.
Well, my favorite scene from Monty Python is a scene of a siege. And it's where they go to besiege the castle where they think the Grail is, they develop the Trojan rabbit, don't they? And they push it up to the walls and they run back and hide.
Yeah, and John Cleese is the taunting Frenchman.
Yeah, exactly that moment there. But I like it when he comes out with the line, "Some kind of badger." Because they want to renegotiate the attempt to get into the castle. And that's my favorite bit of all of the Monty Python canon, and that's under siege, of course.
Thanks so much for joining us today, and I hope you'll come back sometime. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to. I do feel there's so much more that we could talk about, but I think, you know, we have to agree that an hour is the perfect amount of time for a podcast. It's just right. I listen to a lot of podcasts myself, and an hour is bang on. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope your listeners will enjoy some of this. Maybe look out the medieval myth busting blog, or even do me the honor of picking up a copy of the book Historic Building Myth Busting, which is now available in America as well as the UK.
Thanks everyone.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
See you. Adios.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.